So, good morning. Yes, my name is Andre Brnovic. I'm from Stanford. I'm a graduate fellow here. And this rather, hopefully, short talk of some recent work that we've done at Stanford concerning what we call a persistent spin helix. And hopefully, it's going to introduce some new fundamental ideas as well. So this, I first want to acknowledge the collaborators, my advisor, Professor Zhang at Stanford, and on the experimental side, Joe Ornstein and Chris Weber from Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Joe Ornstein actually contributed a lot to the theory side of the paper. Yeah, he's unbelievable. he has a lot of insight, so... So Joe is both on the theory and the experimental paper and contributions.
Well, the system is alpha equals theta, I know it's first.
Right, right. But we're getting close to that. I'll show it immediately. So far there's no experiments for that, but there's a really strong indication for what I'm going to show that has already been observed. So first, I want to give an outline of what I'm going to talk about today. Just very briefly review some mechanisms of spin relaxations in solids. Then go to present an exact SE2 symmetry of spin orbit coupling models. And I explain why this is rather non-trivial. Then I'm going to talk about a new phenomenon that's a result of this exact SE2 symmetry, which we call a persistent spin helix. So it's a configuration of spin that's a helix and that lives forever, hopefully, hence the persistent name. Then I'm going to talk about the Boltzmann equations that put this on a more solid footing. And then I'm going to talk about, very, very briefly, about some recent optical spin grading experiments that are getting close to the regime of this persistent spin helix predicted here. So very briefly, if we don't have spin orbit coupling, basically particle diffusion is the only mechanism to relax the spin. So let's say that I create a wave at some wave vector q of some wavelength, then without spin orbit coupling and without any other coupling between different components of the spin, let's say, the only mechanism that relaxes the spin is diffusion, and here is the relaxation time is just 1 over d, where d is the diffusion constant, times the wave vector squared. And here it's, of course, the spin diffusion constant. Now, if you introduce spin orbit coupling, the dominant mechanism becomes dp relaxation. And this is well known. In some spin orbit coupling field, which is a momentum dependent magnetic field, and for particles that have a momentum relaxation time tau, so the time between collisions of the particles is tau, then the problem of spin relaxation basically reduces to a 2D random walk problem, let's say, if it's in 2D. And it's very easy to get an order of magnitude. Of course, these simple derivations will miss some constants of order 2, depending on the specific spin orbit coupling field that you have in your system. But basically, the main point is that it's a 2D random walk problem. So the angle in between the spin and the SZ component varies over the precession angle over a whole collision interval, which is the spin orbit field times tau, is basically proportional to the time over tau. Hence, the effective reduction of SZ is basically a half, again, factors of one half don't matter, but it's basically the spin orbit coupling field squared times tau times delta t. Hence, if we're to transcribe it into some sort of Boltzmann equation or some sort of decay relaxation equation, what we get is that the time component of the SZ spin, let's say, it's minus 1 over tau S times S, this should be SZ. And this is basically omega squared. This basically tells us that 1 over tau S versus omega squared tau. So this is just the DP relaxation mechanism that we know is valid in 2D electron gas where the spin orbit coupling field is actually small. This is not valid for spin orbit coupling fields that are rather large, and by that I mean this angle, which is the precession angle that the spin undergoes between two collisions, so omega times tau, omega is the spin orbit coupling field. If this angle is large, so of the order 2 pi, then this formula is not valid anymore. Actually, I don't think, people have been telling me that it's not, the formula for the relaxation time is not known in that case. But anyways, for electron gas, this is always the case. So omega, so the spin orbit field times tau is actually very small because the spin orbit coupling is small. So DP relaxation is the relevant mechanism. Now, this poses a very interesting question. We usually, in any type of applications that we want strong spin orbit coupling to be able to manipulate the spin through manipulating the orbit. But it's a catch-22 because strong spin orbit coupling also means strong spin relaxation. So as you see, 1 over tau s is omega squared. So spin relaxes very fast with strong spin orbit coupling. So you always have a problem where you want more spin orbit coupling, but the spin decoheres very fast with more spin orbit coupling. So that's not good. And of course, this is more fundamentally, this is a result of the fact that the spin operator in a system with spin orbit coupling does not commute with a Hamiltonian. So spin is not a conserved quantity. So now I will show you a specific model where you actually can show that you can have both spin orbit coupling and infinite spin lifetime. So now let's look at the specific model first. The specific model is the Rajbrah plus Dresselhaus model, is the two most common forms of spin orbit coupling known. So the Hamiltonian is just a kinetic energy term plus a Rajbrah term, which is just due to quantum LA symmetry and can be experimentally tuned via proper gating. And then the Dresselhaus spin orbit coupling comes from bulk inversion asymmetry and has this form. So, as has been previously pointed out, experimentally nobody yet managed to tune alpha equals to beta, but I will show you that there exists another model where this alpha equals to beta is tuned automatically, so you don't even need to do the tuning. So let's go step by step. First of all, let's look at this Hamiltonian, Rajbrah plus Dresselhaus, and let's look at just the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. So the eigenstates are very easily written down here. There's two of them, and red is, let's say, the plus one, and green is the minus one, and basically this is the picture that the constant energy band structure picture for only Rajbrah. So now I put Dresselhaus to zero, and this is the picture for only Rajbrah. And now I increase Dresselhaus, so let me just make this beta non-zero. Let's see what happens. As you increase Dresselhaus, you can see, I hope, that this Fermi surface starts moving closer and closer together. And now, at beta equals to alpha, they become as shown in this picture. So again, the red one is E plus, the green one is E minus. But now you can notice that exactly at this point, and only at this point, you can characterize the Fermi surfaces by different quantum numbers. So at exactly beta equals to alpha, I can also characterize the Fermi surfaces by these two energies, which are just different quantum numbers. And then I can see that they are just two circles shifted. So basically, this represents a surface of one of the band structure energies, and the green one the other one, and it's very clear that exactly at this point these two things are equivalent. So now these two circles, as you can see right now, they're shifted. So let's just focus for the moment just on the case alpha equals to beta, or the Hamiltonian. I just rewrite the previous Rashba plus Dresselhaus Hamiltonian is of the following form. So it's just the kinetic term, plus this is the 1-1-0 direction, and this is the 1-1-bar-0 direction. So this is the momentum on 1-1-0 direction times the spin on the 1-1-bar direction. Now, if you make a global spin rotation, so this is global coordinate independent spin rotation, and you make a coordinate change, canonical, then your Hamiltonian for Rashba equals Dresselhaus basically transforms into the following Hamiltonian, kinetic term, minus 2 times alpha, alpha being equal to beta. K plus means 1-1-0. Sigma z is just the Pauli matrix of 1 and minus 1. So now you can see immediately that this Hamiltonian is equivalent to the Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model. So if basically I put my quantum well, a symmetric quantum well, and I grow it in the 1-1-0 direction, the k cube term in the bulk will basically give rise upon two-dimensional momentum quantization to this Hamiltonian for the 1-1-0 model. So these two models are equivalent mathematically. It's just that the Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model basically has kx here, whereas the Rashba equals to Dresselhaus model has k plus here. So again, although Rashba equals to Dresselhaus has not been realized experimentally because it's hard yet to tune the value of the Rashba field to be equal to the value of the Dresselhaus field, there is a model which is Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model where you can do this by default.
I mean, this symmetric quantum well on the 1-1-0 surface was discussed theoretically, and a spin relaxation being suppressed was also measured.
That's right. So there was Arno. That's right. So I'll show exactly what that means. So
the point is about the 1-1-0 that experimentally it holds even, or in real system it holds even in higher order. I mean, you restrict yourself to the k-linear terms, and when you have the 1-1-0 surface, even the higher order terms will have the same structure, so that you need not restrict yourself to the
right. But I mean, in the 1-1-0 direction, the terms that would spoil this are some other Rashba terms that show up from asymmetry. That's a good point. So what has been known indeed for this model and experimentally is you can see that if you take sigma z here and commute it with this Hamiltonian, then sigma z commutes with the Hamiltonian. So as z spin is basically a good quantum number, so it will not decay. And this has been seen experimentally, where you can see very large spin relaxation times in this direction. However, what I want to point out is that that's just a U1 symmetry, basically. It's not the full SU2. So it's basically, it's not a trivial symmetry, but from a mathematical point of view, it is a trivial symmetry. It just commutes immediately with a Hamiltonian. And that's the reason why it doesn't decay. And experimentally, it has been seen, and that's a hard experiment. So now, I want to go back to the shifting property. So both the Rashba and the Rashba equals to Dresselhaus and the Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model have the following shifting property. So you look at the two Fermi surfaces. Now this is the Fermi surface, let's say, for spin up, and this is the Fermi surface for spin down, or vice versa. In any case, green and red are two different directions of SZ. So now you can see that for the Rashba equals to Dresselhaus model, there is a shifting property, that is, the energy that is these circles are basically shifted by a wave vector q. So the any point on the Fermi surface of the downspin at momentum k is exactly equal to a point of the upspin and momentum k plus q. So for Rashba equals to Dresselhaus model, this shifting vector is actually parallel to the 1-1-0 direction and has no component on the other direction. Whereas for the Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model, the shifting wave vector is parallel to the x direction and has no component on the y direction. So again, these models are completely equivalent except for a 45 degree rotation in xy space. So what does this mean? So what we found is that this means that there's actually a full SE2 symmetry of the model. So you can build spin operators that fulfill the full SE2 algebra and that commute with a Hamiltonian. However, you have to build them at finite wave vector. So the first spin operator is the SZ spin operator, which was known to commute with a Hamiltonian. Is basically what I said before. It was also discovered experimentally. And this is at zero wave vector. So the spin operator, the Z spin operator at zero wave vector, commutes with the Hamiltonian. However, now we take two spin operators, S plus and S minus, the other two spin operators, and we form them in the following way. Basically, you annihilate an electron here, you shift it, and you create one here. So these give you another two spin operators, and you can check that they fulfill an SE2 algebra. These two are at finite wave vector q, which is actually the shifting wave vector of the Fermi surfaces. So now the shifting property is actually essential to prove that these are conserved quantities. So if you take the commutator of, actually we can even focus on the local spin, so we don't even need to sum over k. Just focus on the local spin. Just take the commutator of the Hamiltonian with the local spin. This basically gives you a difference between the energies of the up at k plus q and the energy of the down at k, but due to the shifting property, this is zero. So this is an exact SE2 symmetry that is actually even the local operators commute with the Hamiltonian. The reason why we have to put global operators, the reason why you have to sum over all momenta, is that the local operators don't actually satisfy the SE2 algebra. So it's only a full SE2 algebra for the global spin. So again, the previously known example was just the U1 symmetry. It was known and exploited basically in Schliemann, I guess, and Loss for the Rashba equals Dresselhaus model, and Hall et al. For the Dresselhaus 1-1-0 model, and basically led to some proposals of Das Dada devices in the diffusive regime rather than the ballistic regime. So the original Das Dada was in the ballistic regime, but now due to this symmetry, Schliemann and Hall basically proposed Das Dada in the diffusive regime. But again, the symmetry is just the U1, does not contain the full spin, SE2.
This sum over K you have, is it over all occupied and unoccupied state, or what does it mean, this sum over K?
It's over all occupied states, basically.
And you assume some Fermi distribution, or...
Yeah, it's all the momenta, but you sum basically over all the momenta. It's an operator, so it's not, I haven't, when I'll get to the Boltzmann equation, I'll sum over all the occupy states then.
So it means...
This is just operator.
Summing over all k vectors occupied and non-occupied.
Well, in this case, yeah, but when you get to the Boltzmann equation, you need to sum up to the Fermi surface, yeah. And I'll show you in that case how it goes.
So the SE2 symmetry also holds...
Right.
For both models.
So the two models are exactly the same, are exactly equivalent up to a...
And what Roland says that, of course, this Rajpad-Dresselhaus model has higher order k to the power 3 term, right?
This one?
Yes.
Yeah, so for that one...
Correctly is that you do not have to worry about the higher order terms in the...
Experiment or if you look at it with a 8x8 model or something like that, you can define an effective magnetic field that includes higher orders in the K vector, and for the 110 surface, this effective magnetic field in all orders of K is perpendicular to the 2D surface. So when you have a spin oriented parallel or anti-parallel to this effective magnetic field being perpendicular, it will always be a stable configuration no matter what momentum scattering you have from one K vector to another one. The electrons will always experience an effective field parallel or anti-parallel to this spin.
Yeah, so I didn't know for the 110 model that it holds. So indeed, for Rajpad equals Dresselhaus, I neglect K cube terms for this shifting to be valid.
There's a student of Bert Halperin who sort of claimed that this K cube spin scattering was very
poor.
There's a quantum dot experiment, I think. I think Charlie Marcus's group did some weak anti-localization to get all the terms. Rajpad, Dresselhaus, and cubic Dresselhaus, but I think it's still smaller than so the Dresselhaus term is actually quite large, the K-linear term, and of course it depends what filling you're at. So you'd expect that for low, so K-cubed will definitely become more important for higher density samples.
Yeah, but this is not concerned for the data.
Right.
Nice.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't know that this is kept to the to higher orders in this.
Does mean that SU2 symmetry would also hold for this extended Hamiltonian?
Yeah. I don't know that. Yeah, I doubt it too, actually. Yeah, if you have cubic terms, it's probably because you need, so the reason why this holds is you have linear terms, and the k squared term, this term when you shift it gives you a linear term which cancels the shifting of this term. So for k cubed, I think it's probably one.
You have this linear k and only have one polymetric to go up. So the second term is actually linear, and you can actually gauge
your way. Yeah, of course.
Because of the gauge information, you got this symmetry. So what do you include other?
Well, it's because of the shifting property.
There's some numerical
pattern. So I think there will be other Fermi surfaces that will have a shifting property, and I'll talk about that.
And some term.
Right. Yeah. Fine tuning.
The spectrum.
Right. Right. Okay, so basically what's interesting is that the symmetry is actually independent, is robust against disorder and many body interactions, as long as they're spin independent. So again, here the local symmetry is not, but the global symmetry is. So if you take the spin operators and commute them with any spin-dependent disorder and Coulomb or many-body interactions, as long as they're spin-dependent, you find that it holds. The symmetry is robust to these effects. So it's a true symmetry of the Hamiltonian in this. Well, of these two Hamiltonians, one of them in a contrived limit, including interactions. So what does this mean now? Now let's focus on just Dresselhaus 110. So in Dresselhaus 110, it means that the SX and SY components of the spin will form a helix with wave vector Q that has infinite lifetime. So that's why we call it a persistent spin helix. Of course, for the Rajba equals to Dresselhaus, there will be other components that will form the spin helix, as I will show right away.
Here, suppose you add this spin-independent disorder, very, very strong, then I understand all this mathematical algebra still shows the SO2 symmetry is still exact. But then, for this
if you have
this to the Fermi surface shifted picture.
So actually I think so the algebra works pretty well no matter what the disorder is, but what I will show you afterwards in a little bit is that if you do basically Boltzmann transport, you can see that it's not a contrived example in the sense that you still get very long lifetimes even for alpha not equal to beta. So even for the Fermi surface is not at perfect nesting. So it's not a singular point, in other words. So from the picture of the Fermi surfaces here, okay, here you'd think that it's a singular point at which the symmetry holds. But only in this case you can go from this to this. But that's actually not true. It's not a singular point. Okay, so now we can understand this persistent spin helix from a very simple picture. So let's look at Rajba equals to Dresselhaus, and let's look at basically particles moving in the Rajba equals to Dresselhaus Hamiltonian, and this is the x plus direction. So again, as I said before, in this case, the Fermi surfaces are shifted on the x plus direction with a shifting wave vector q equals 4 times the mass times the alpha, the Rajba spin orbit coupling. So let's put two particles that start with the same spin at the same position, let's say 0, on the x plus axis, and on the x minus axis, so on this axis, it doesn't matter where they are. And now, let's give them some momentum, and again, it doesn't matter in which direction I give them the momentum. What turns out is that when they move at different velocities, as you can see. However, their spin configurations are the same. So if I were to plot the spin configurations versus the x plus axis, they will be the same after the same distance traveled. So the spin precession angle just depends on the direction, on the distance that the particles have moved on the x plus axis. It doesn't depend on the x minus. It doesn't depend on the moment, on the initial velocities, basically. After a wavelength equal to 2 pi over this shifting wave vector, the particles return to the same spin configuration.
Similar to Kruger's experiments with bulk gallium arsenide in the presence of his strain-induced spin splitting, where he also found a coherent spin precession independent of the K vector of the electrons?
These are the...
Scott Kruger.
How does it spell his name?
C-R-O-O-K-E-R.
Well, so it, I, these, so the, those are bulk experiments, right, as I said.
Yeah.
So it's...
The spin splitting is essentially the same in the sense that it's the same structure. You use the strain in order to get a spin splitting that is essentially like the Rajba term.
Right.
Only that the prefactor scales as a function of strain, whereas in 2D system we do this argument as a function of gate voltage.
So the reason why this happens here, why it's just a matter of the distance on the x plus axis is because you have only one. It's again just having one spin orbit coupling field. So again, just having sigma z. So I don't know if those experiments are actually tuned at some specific point. So I haven't read.
It was essentially the point that he had a spin split in linear in the wave vector k. That was his important point.
Right. But for example, if I have a Rajbah Hamiltonian with both of them, just Rajbah, no Dressel house, then this would not happen. So if I just have this is an exact consequence of these two Fermi surfaces being shifted. So if I have Rajbah equals to Dressel house, for example, the precession angle on the precession angle will basically depend on both x minus and x plus distance traveled, I think. So I'm not. I don't think this would happen for just. So this would definitely not happen for just pure Rajbah, I think. So. Now, basically, what this says is that the spin configurations do not depend on the particle initial momenta. For the same x plus distance traveled, again, the same process, the spin processes by exactly the same angle. And after a length, 2 pi h bar over the shifting wave vector, the spins return exactly to the original configuration. So this is basically a persistent spin helix in a physical picture. Now, let's look at... We need to transform back to the original basis, but basically, this is how the persistent spin helix looks for the Rajbah equals to Dressel house and Dressel house 110 model. So for the Rajbah equals to Dressel house, the persistent spin helix will be in the z x plus plane, okay? Whereas for the Dressel house 110, the persistent spin helix will be in the x y plane. So here the red are the spins which form this persistent configuration, and the blue is the spin orbit coupling field that you would get for this type of a configuration.
I don't understand that. Previously you said that they are related just by 45 degree rotation. So
it's in coordinate space is related by a 45 degree rotation. However, right. So in spin space, you see here I had to change, I had to make a unitary transformation and change the. So basically this gives. This is sigma minus, and this is the only one that does not contribute to the. So again, this sigma minus is the symmetry that was known before. So you see, sigma minus would commute with this Hamiltonian, is the symmetry that was known before. The persistent spin helix is made by exactly the other two components. So sigma z and sigma plus in the Rajbah equals to Dressel house. In the 110 model, since you already have here sigma z from the very beginning, it's just sx and sy. So it's the other, it's not the U1 part of the symmetry. So yeah, you need to transform back to the, you need to make the global transformation back. So now again, of course, this is just 2 pi over the shifting wave vector. So we can also understand this from, as was pointed out in the audience, by a gauge sort of perspectives, in the sense that in this case, in the case where I have Rajbah equals Dressel house or just Dressel house 110, I can basically put the spin orbit coupling term of the Hamiltonian into the kinetic energy term and express the Hamiltonian as electrons interacting with a gauge potential, which in this case is non-abelian. So here on the K plus I just subtract 2m Rajbah spin orbit coupling times sigma z, and you can see that this is a non-abelian gauge potential, background gauge potential that's constant. In this case, the field strength actually vanishes. So as you know, if I would have a Rajbah model, so I would have both sigma x and sigma y, the field strength would not vanish. But in this case, basically the field strength vanishes. So you can eliminate this vector potential by a non-abelian gauge transformation. So the spin-up components, you transform them with positive shifting wave vector over 2. And the spin-down components, you transform them with negative shifting wave vector over 2. So in between them, they're transformed by exactly the shifting wave vector. In this case, the Hamiltonian actually just reduces to a Fermi gas without spin-orbit coupling. However, well, first of all, I should say that since the system is metallic, this gauge transformation does not have any consequence to the system. If it had off-diagonal long-range order, then it would have consequences. But like this, it doesn't have any consequence, besides the fact that this transformation is actually is non-trivial in the S-minus and S-plus operators. So again, you can see that this S-minus and S-plus operators actually combine up with down. So S-minus operator actually shifted by the shifting wave vector, and S-plus operator is shifted by exactly opposite. So one is shifted by minus the shifting wave vector, the other one is shifted by plus, by positive. So you can say that mathematically, the persistent spin helix is a direct manifestation of a non-abelian flux in the ground state of these two models. So now, to really understand this from a more quantitative point of view, you actually need to derive some Boltzmann equations that will give you the motion of all the components of the spin and the charge. And these are the equations that I derived. So basically, charge couples with both x plus and x minus components of the spin. And in this case, you can't really see very well the structure of these equations. But basically, let me just say the persistent spin helix comes from these two terms. So you can look here, and you can see that exactly at alpha equals beta. So these equations are valid for alpha, for Rajbah and Dresselhaus difference. So exactly at alpha equals to beta, this term cancels, and all you're left with is just these terms. And I will come back to this later to show you how you can see the persistent spin helix from here. I should also point out that in the case of just beta equals to zero, so Dresselhaus equals to zero, the transport equations were actually obtained before by first Burka and McDonald, and then by Mischenko, Shidov, and Halperin in 2004. However, introducing a beta basically gives another level of complexity because the Fermi surfaces become highly anisotropic. So now, let's just go again to the point alpha equals to beta and understand the spin helix from, again, just a gauge transformation perspective. So through the gauge transformation, I showed that the Hamiltonian can be reduced to a free Fermi gas with the only consequence that the S minus and S plus components of the spin are shifted by this shifting wave vector. So they're related to the old components or to the new components. So new components are related to the old components by just a rotation matrix. Now, in the new gauge transform Hamiltonian, since the free Fermi gas, the spin actually just undergoes a simple diffusion equation. So Sx equals to constant is a infinite lifetime solution of this equation. But now you can transform it back to the old system before gauge transformation, and that basically just gives you the solution Sx and Sy equals cosine of 4m alpha x plus, which is 4m alpha is just this q, and sinus, which is just the persistent spin helix. now, even for alpha, not equal to beta, so even for this, away from this point that we've been focusing on for the talk, the transport equations decouple in 2x2 blocks. But this happens only on two specific directions. So if you have propagation on 1-1 borrow, so if you have propagation on this axis, what happens is that n couples with x, with the spin component on x plus, and sz couples with the spin component on x minus. You can find the characteristic frequencies, which basically give you the decay of these components. And these are the characteristic frequencies. They're not very transparent here. But what you can see from these is that in this case, so for propagation on this direction, the behavior of fz is diffusive and exponentially decaying. So this we call the passive direction. Now, for propagation on 1-1-0, for which the shifting wave vector, where the shifting wave vector lies, n couples with sx minus, and sz couples with sx plus from the transport equations, and the characteristic frequencies basically have the property that at the shifting wave vector, if you plug everything in, at the shifting wave vector, this one of the two characteristic frequencies becomes zero. So they're all imaginary, but at exactly the shifting wave vector, one of them becomes zero. So that means that this is the infinite lifetime spin helix, and that this is the active direction of the system. So now, how would you detect this? Well, the most suited experiments, I guess, up to now, are the optical spin grating experiments. So in these spin grating experiments, actually, you can make them, you can perform them in two modes. You can perform them in a charge mode, or you can perform them in the spin only mode. So let me explain what that means. Basically, you make two polarized beams interfere on a sample, and depending on how these beams are polarized, you can either excite a density profile in the sample. If actually these beams are polarized linearly, you excite a density profile. If they're polarized orthogonally, you actually what you excite is only a spin profile in the sample. So of course you excite both electron and hole spin, but the hole spin relaxes much faster than the electron spin. So actually these experiments, what they actually measure is just the electron spin polarization. So it turns out that if you go through the mass, the interference of two orthogonally polarized beams basically creates a helicity wave, which would couple to the spin polarization of the electron. And you can create, basically, you can create a spin density that looks exactly like this. And you can vary Q, and what you can measure in the end is the spin as a function of Q and time. And the way you do this is that once you've created, so it's a pump probe experiment, once you've created this spin configuration, what you do is you send a probe beam, and this probe beam is sensitive to the change in the index of refraction of the sample due to this to the spin polarization wave that you've created, and we'll have optical birefringence. So basically, you can measure the amplitude of the diffracted beam, and you can measure the z component as a function of Q and time. What's that? Right, so the angle of incident, that will vary, basically that varies the Q. Right. So now, so this was actually used by Weber to, Weber and Al to show some nice spin Coulomb drag experiments in 2005. And I should point out that this is actually, well, I've been told, the most sensitive technique to measure spin-orbit coupling. or to measure any spin type of effects optically. So now let me show you, like, this is preliminary data. This ring with the red is the passive direction, and this is the way S or SZ actually decays with time. And black is the active direction. So you can see that in the active direction, the spin relaxation time is much, much longer than the passive direction. That's gallium arsenide. I think it's multiple quantum well gallium arsenide. So, sorry? Yeah, I think yeah.
So how do we get the Rajba interaction?
So the Rajba interaction, so that was one of the things we were wondering about. So,
I mean, you can have, say, asymmetric doping.
Right. Or just from the interface in between them, for example, you can so you can have Rajba interactions in nominally symmetric quantum wells just from the interface field. So if you have different,
can you write down the potential profile?
No, I don't know enough about this sample to really address your question. It's a very important question, but I don't know enough about the sample.
How would it be clear that the Rajba is actually close but not equal to Grass Hart then?
So, okay, so let's...
So you conclude from these experiments that Rajba is close, not optically, say, make a sample where Rajba is close.
Yeah,
right. So. Right. Well. But yeah. That, but.
That's an equal fate, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's. Yeah. Well, I'll show you more, but. It is a leap of faith, but on the other hand, it's very strange that you measure onto the 1-1 borrow direction and you get one spin relaxation lifetime, and you measure onto the 1-1-0 direction, you get 10 times larger. I don't think it's such a large leap of faith. So again, the reason why this doesn't live forever is because Rajba is not equal to Dresslau. So now this is a fitting to the formulas of to the Boltzmann equation formulas here, to these omegas, basically, where these omegas, so these constants, they have an expression in terms of alpha, beta, Fermi momentum, and tau. And these are measured independently. So now this is a fitting of the data, a preliminary fitting, I should say. I should be very careful about that. So to the data to those formulas. So this is this direction is just the diffusive direction. So this is decay time as a function of wave vector. So this is basically I omega, those characteristic frequencies. I omega is just 1 over time, tau s effective, I should say. And it's a function of Q. It's a function of Q. So now this is a fit, and this is the diffusive direction, and this is the direction in which you get the persistent spin helix. Well, hopefully, if you can get to alpha equals to beta point. So now, fitting of this data basically gives Rajba over Dresselhaus of the order 0.3. So Rajba is 0.3, the value of the Dresselhaus for these.
Could it also be the other way around? This reminds me of experiments that were done recently at the Joffre Institute, where they measured the, is essentially a related thing, the anisotropic spin relaxation for spin orientation in the 110 direction and the minus 100 direction, and they got a similar ratio. Of course, you never know whether Raschke or Dresselhaus is the larger one.
Yeah, I agree.
Their conclusion was just the opposite. That
So I agree. So what? Yes, you're definitely right. So that's a very important insight.
Excuse me, this was not Ganichev.
Ganichev had also a paper out.
Yes, yeah, but this is... but the experiment was different.
Yes, but they concluded from this experiment all from the alpha versus
beta. The Ganichev experiment was different in the sense that they were very proud not just have the ratio, but really be able to get whether Raschke is larger than Dresselhaus or why.
Yeah, that's a very, very astute remark. You're definitely right. It's these equations actually just give you the ratio, and you're not able to say which one is which. The way we said that Raschke is smaller than Dresselhaus is because these wells were nominally symmetric. So if you would have Raschke three times larger than Dresselhaus, then that would be a big surprise coming from they weren't grown to be very asymmetric. So that's the reason why we put that.
You say alpha is smaller than.
Right.
But that was also done.
No, other way around. He found Raschke being larger than Dresselhaus.
No, it can be, but these samples were not prepared for tuning.
We have here a funny additional contribution to that.
A funny addition.
Yes, I mean, it's been going on for I don't know how long. Ganichev found it was the opposite, and it's always
no, but I mean,
apples and oranges.
You can definitely find.
Try to put gate voltage on it. I mean, for instance, in Nita's group, apparently they can change the Raschke coupling about 30%. Then you can see how this goes. I do agree. When you revert that, that's related by the transformation. So by this, you can never differentiate which one is bigger.
The problem with Nita's experiment is once again that you compare apples with oranges because you change the density also, which makes things more complicated.
Right.
You need two gates, a front gate and a back gate, which
maintain
experimentally yet more difficult. You're always comparing apples with oranges.
Well, the only reason why you can't measure the actual which one's the actual Raschke and which one's the actual Dresselhaus is because you're sensitive only to the full magnitude of this SZ. So if you were able to measure, in principle, it should be very easy to measure which one is which because they have different orientations. So Raschke just goes like this, and Dresselhaus changes sign, right? So you subtract 110. So if you know the direction, if you're sensitive to the direction, you would be able to say if you're sensitive to the direction, you'd be able. So here, let's say I have this and Dresselhaus is let's say kx sigma x minus ky sigma y. So right, so I have here I have this, right? So here it's like this, right? And here it's like this, right?
This lower figure.
Right, so this is Dresselhaus, kx sigma x minus ky sigma y. So this is kx.
Okay, you're right.
So if you know the direction, it's definitely possible to measure them because you can look at.
But you always have a more or less a Fermi distribution all these directions.
But I think if you know the sign, if you know the actual sign of the spin orbit coupling B field, you can distinguish which one is which.
Yeah, it was only very recently Ganicek was very proud of it, that they had an experiment that allowed them to do that explicitly. I talked with Ganicek about that. He was very proud.
So let's look here. So if you have right, so this one on the 110 would look like this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Rajba would be like this too. Okay, so if you knew the direction, then on this side there will be exactly opposite. So if you knew the direction, you could measure either of them.
I agree. The only point is that when you average in an experiment over the Fermi contour, then it doesn't help you.
Yeah, but you can do what Ashlam did, right? With these, you can drag the there's that 2004 Nature paper. You can drag the spin and then measure the B field immediately. You can drag by an electric field, the spin packet, and measure its precession. And that measures, so they claim that they measure the well, it's a strain field in that case, but it's the same as Rajba and Dresselhaus, basically. And they claim they measure the sign.
To the best of my knowledge, it was only Ganicek's paper that really did this fairly properly, I believe. But anyway.
I see.
I'm kind of surprised that even for such a small Rajba correction, we still find such a huge difference.
Well, so it's a third, right? A fifth to a third. So I don't think it's very surprising. I mean. Well, no, it doesn't correspond to the gut feeling, but it corresponds to, I mean, it fits rather well. I think the everything fits together rather well. Right? I don't think there's any other reason why you should see huge spin lifetime in 110 and just complete diffusion on 1-1 baro.
I would expect in order to see the things different, that the ratio should be lower.
Well, I mean, it's not a huge difference. It's 10 times larger, 8 times larger. So you're right. It's not a huge difference. It's just 10 times larger or 8 times larger, I guess. So, but basically, so there's. I just wanted to go through one short thing before. I end. So basically, although I told you that with this gauge transformation at this special point, the system becomes just a free Fermi gas, that's not actually entirely true. Because if it was just a free Fermi gas, then you couldn't explain, for example, experiments by Vanessa Sieg and other people where they see in just 110 Dresselhaus quantum wells, they see uniform spin polarization in the bulk. So you take your sample, you put an electric field, and you see a spin polarization. Actually, what they see is they see it on the z direction because they look in 110 Dresselhaus. But for example, in the Rajba equals to Dresselhaus, if you would put an E field parallel to 110, you'd see a spin polarization in the 1-1 baro. So this doesn't really fit with what I told you before, that it's really a free Fermi gas at these points. And the reason why it doesn't fit is because it's an order of limit issue, actually. So if you are to look for spin polarization in the bulk, you actually have to be very careful and look first at the equations away from the alpha equals to beta point. Okay, because actually what turns out to happen is that the electric field, which is just the gradient of some density, is related to spin with two coefficients that actually go to zero. So as you can see, B1 goes to zero as alpha or Rajba equals to beta or Dresselhaus, but T2, which is the basically inverse of the relaxation time, also goes to zero as alpha equals to beta squared. So their ratio is actually a constant. So there's this slight order of limit issue that makes the system at alpha equals to beta not be essentially a free Fermi gas in terms of DC transport.
Of course, we can go back to the more complicated things and okay solution. But wouldn't that just really because then if I set the detail to be finite, I mean a trivial uniform electric field in the left frame after you do this gauge information actually becomes something rather complicated, and that's why that you get this non.
Well, you'd expect that the G factor would, you'd say that it would become a magnetic field.
You get really different things because they're saying that it's not fair to describe a free fermion, but what you're saying in real left frame is really a very complicated perturbation for free fermion, which we haven't studied before.
I think even if you make gauge transformation on the electric field when alpha equals to beta, you would not get the spin polarization in the bulk because basically the spin doesn't enter in that case. So I guess you would say that you change it to a magnetic field and then spin polarizes.
It's a gauge transformation, which means I'm basically just redefine the quantization axis on my spins. So it's just a matrix modification, and I see no reason why it should fail. The only reason why it failed is really because that even for a trivial Fermi gas, it will apply a very funny spiraling electric field in a funny direction. It will give it some funny things, which we have no motivation to study before, but now we do.
I don't understand what funny things you give, but what I'm saying, I think it's true. If
like a simple fluid in a spin channel,
well, no, but then you have then it's not a metallic system, right? If you then you couldn't say that it's just a free Fermi gas. You'd have off diagonal long range order. So, but in this, but the point is that you really need to look at the systems. When you look at DC transport or all these, you know, spin galvanic effects or everything, you need to look at the system away from alpha equals to beta and do the limiting properly. So, anyways, just to close. Basically, I've shown that it's possible to minimize spin decoherence while keeping strong spin orbit coupling. I want to also point out that this shifted Fermi surface, we now believe that it could be a fundamental property of some condensed matter systems. In a way, it's similar to nesting. If you think about nesting, it relates particles at some wave vector k with holes at the wave vector k plus q. And then you get all these divergences in susceptibilities that basically lead you to some textbook phenomena such as CDW or other things. In this case, shifted Fermi surfaces basically relate not particles to holes, but particles to particles in two Fermi surfaces. So we believe that this property of shifting is actually similar to nesting. Now we've shown that there's an exact SE2 symmetry of two classes of models, Rushby equal to Dresselhaus and Dresselhaus 1-0, and there's a finite wave vector generators, SE2 generators, that give rise to a persistent spin helix. And I guess there's some indication that this persistent spin helix can be experimentally observed through fine-tuning. Thank you.
Well, you mentioned the experiment of C and alpha, but have you also tried to find out whether you get some more effect in terms of dynamic relations?
Yeah, so you don't. It's so these equations.
How would you treat the boundary conditions?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the boundary conditions. You're right, but if you put soft boundary, I think you don't get any. There's definitely no spin current from the.
It should be different whether you have sort of boundaries.
Right, the hard boundary and soft boundary.
Or normal to the spin helix, right?
Oh, you mean in terms of spin helix? I see. Yeah, we didn't look into that. But in terms of the spin Hall effect, these transport equations actually include these vertex corrections, which kill the effect for this case. So since it's actually, I think you can prove this theorem that for linear spin orbit coupling, the spin, I think it's been proven actually by some people, the spin Hall effect cancels.
Right, but the pinch is still something can happen. Like
right, depending on the boundary conditions.
This is rather complicated, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but I think. Yeah, it depends. I mean, it definitely depends. You get some spin accumulation depending on the boundary condition that you put on.
Is there a universal understanding of spin accumulation at this point? I think John Schumann sort of got a similar diffusion equation, and you can just use very simple averaging to show that the current is vanishing the bulk.
Well, but that's not a good way to look at it, because spin current is you have some definition that you use for spin current, and that definition might cancel, but some other person comes with another definition that doesn't cancel. So the right way is spin accumulation.
Yeah, you just solve your transform equation.
Right.
And boundaries.
Right.
Boundaries, they can have spin things, so
yeah.
You get some spin accumulation.
Right. So I think
it is definitely more complicated.
Yeah.
And it would be for the central rush factor.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I agree that the thing to look at is not the spin current, it's the spin accumulation. Just solving the transport equations without even talking about spin current.
And these experiments of C were exactly for this special 110 Bresson house.
Right.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So that's
but we didn't look at
yeah.
We just looked at the spin polarization, the bulk. We didn't look at. I agree they have spin Hall in those experiments, but we didn't get to that yet.
Well, I don't remember exactly the experiment, but there's also something
to yeah, so they saw, so they, the claim is, so they were trying to, so the original experiments, I think there was a controversy because they were, the interpretation as extrinsic was excluding this Dresselhaus term. So now what they did is they went on 110 where you just have this is the only field that you have, and I believe they still see they still see behavior consistent with the extrinsic spin Hall effect, but I don't know why. I don't remember. So thank you.
We came down specially for the sample to here.
Well, no, I was supposed to be here.
Good.
How long does it take to come down?
It's all driving here. So it's not
a lot of time to think, right?
Did you have you ever done the drive?
Pardon me?
Have you ever done the drive?
Now, yeah, sort of. And in fact, I did it. That was a night and together with your partner.
Ah, jeez. How was you're still alive?
Yeah.
Does he match his reputation?
Yeah, of course. So in the beginning he drove very nicely, and then sometimes he got sleep, so this reflects for he fell asleep, and then he was, oh, that's not good. Let's put up some speed, and then he really doubled it.
Really?
He was doing more than 100. Yeah, but, that's better.
He never gets caught.
Unlike
he's rich enough, I guess.
Yeah.
That matches his reputation, yes, definitely.
Yeah.